the internet, and welcome to season 3, episode 2 of the Daily Zeitgeist for October 24th, 2017. My name is Jack O'Brien, aka Potatoes O'Brien, aka Young Jackfruit, aka Obi-Wan Play No D, and I am joined by my co-host, Mr. Miles Gray.
Oh, yes, your boy's in the building. Miles Gray, aka your boy Kusama, aka Yoko. Oh, no, you didn't.
All
That's
right.
A new one for you.
I love it. And in our third seat today, we're thrilled to be joined by Jamie Loftus.
Hello, aka Jerry Lorbach.
Jerry Lorbach.
Yeah.
Where did that name come from?
Jerry Lorbach. I'm Jerry Orbach's evil twin who's still alive.
Love it.
His eyes are in someone's head, right?
But yeah, you're looking at him, baby. Jerry Lorbach.
Jamie, what's something that you've searched for in the past couple days that is revealing of who you are as a human being?
Oh, boy. Okay, so last night, Dateline was on at a bar because that's the kind of bar I frequent. It's my favorite season. I watch Dateline religiously, but it's my favorite season for Dateline because Lester Holt is wearing, like, really thick turtlenecks, and Keith Morrison was reporting. So I looked up one of my old favorite Instagram accounts, Keith Leans on Things, where Keith Morrison is found leaning on really every object
anything.
You can imagine. Anything.
He's the master of the lean.
He is in control of his body 100% because these things he's leaning on are not always stable. There's a picture of him leaning on a leaf, in one, like a large palm leaf.
Right.
He's in total control.
Yeah.
And he's hot.
I just like to think he's incapable of standing
straight up.
So he always has to sort of, it's actually right. like out of necessity.
He's just like propped up. They're just like, all right. And we're gonna situate here.
He's got like a faulty leg.
I feel like let's not rule out that he has like little hollow bird bones, you know? Like
right.
he might just be trying to ground himself somewhere so he doesn't blow away.
Right. He is the guy who Bill Hader does the impression of, right?
Yeah.
It's like, oh no.
Flawlessly.
Yeah. So overrated, underrated. What do you got for your OV?
All right, my OV is Weird Al's music being used on The Walking Dead. I think, man, what a dumb.
What do you mean? Wait, they use it like as a theme song?
They used it
during an episode. What song did they use again?
Another one, Rides the Bus.
Oh, incredible, creative genius, Weird Al.
Did they use it as like a music bed to a scene, or like it was ambient within the scene, like they just happened to be in a car that was playing Weird Al?
No, I'm pretty sure it was like using it as a bed under a scene. Like,
wow.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Potentially accidentally. I don't know. Maybe they thought they were using Another One Bites the Dust. And they just used Another One Rides the Bus.
It got
or
to the point they broadcast.
Cheaper for licensing.
Right.
Like a good alternative.
Right.
But overrated Weird Al in general, if you're over 8 years old and still about that life, maybe time to grow up. I'm sorry.
I personally,
don't at me.
Yeah, don't at me, bro. I personally, I'm of the same mind. I'm not a huge Weird Al fan. I haven't been since I was like 8.
Appropriate.
Wow, look at you, elitist over here.
I'm sorry. Yeah, we're both sitting on stacks of New Yorkers right now.
Right.
Jack's whole outfit is made of Economist covers. But like, yeah, I liked Weird Al as a kid. You're right. But I think I wrote it out to at least 13. I wasn't like one of these. I didn't jump off the ship at 8. Like after Amish Paradise, I was like, okay, we're good.
There's men in their 30s who are still like firmly like, how could you not want to listen to this with me in my car? Like, no.
Oh, no.
I don't.
What kind of dates are you going on?
Listen, I'm going on some real sinister dates.
Yeah. Go to a bar that plays Dateline on the TV and there's like, hey, girl, you want to go to my car and listen to some Weird Al mixtapes?
Oh, what a time to be alive.
What's underrated?
My undie would be and this is just something that I've been listening to a lot recently, is the music of Yanni. I feel like no. Because you can't OV the music of Yanni, but I feel like people don't talk about his music. It doesn't come up enough in my regular life.
Hold on. What's like a Yanni jam?
Because
I think most people dismiss Yanni. Actually, it's true. Like, by just looking at him and they're like, oh, that's not for me. That's just long haired dude.
They do the same thing to Kenny G where it's just like the men are very talented. I feel like Yanni should be just as in pop culture as Kenny G is, because at least he's like, you know, he's in like Funny or Die stuff. He's all over the place. Yanni, like maybe it's personal preference where he's like, actually, I'm going to keep it real. I'm a musician. But I feel like Yanni should be everywhere.
Well,
he's not.
Shout out to Kenny G because he's mastered the art of circular breathing. So mm-hmm. as someone who's played a woodwind mm-hmm. or trumpet instrument,
yeah.
to sustain a note for however like an hour or however long he did that, that's some techers.
Wait, what did you play?
I played trumpet.
I played oboe.
You did?
Yeah.
Wow, good for you. Did you make your own reeds?
I did make my own reeds.
Oh, so you're about that life.
I was about that life. Circular breathing is, I mean, I never arrived there.
I couldn't either. It's too in-depth.
You can't. But making reeds is crazy because I was in high school and my band instructor literally gave me a knife, which you should not do to a high schooler, right. but you need a knife to make a reed. So he's just like, and now I give you, a teenager, a knife. That was the only cool.
He was fired later that day.
I had the only sanctioned knife in the entire high school.
Really regretting jumping on the same bandwagon as you with your musical taste with the Weird Al thing. Now that you're going pro Yanni and
I've taken down
Kenny
Weird
G.
Al, I'm lifting up Yanni.
Wow.
And Kenny G, I mean, Kenny G is a master, but he gets a lot of attention. Yanni doesn't get the attention he deserves.
Does Yanni have anything to do with the Yanni steam?
That's why I've been thinking about Yanni a lot,
right.
because I'm getting a Yanni steam. I've purchased a Yanni egg, which is just a vagina rock that is supposed to give you superpowers or something. And so I've been thinking a lot about Yanni. I'm going to listen to Yanni while I've
Take
got
the Yanni
my
steam.
Exactly.
Is Yanni a
full Yanni
pseudonym? Or like
yeah,
a,
what, why is it called the Yanni steam? And also tell people what the Yanni steam is.
Okay, so I am getting a Yanni steam tomorrow, which is basically... as I understand it, it's just blowing steam up your vagina and it's supposed to make you happy or like, like fertile. And like, it's an ancient art. Like Yanni is like a very, very old, centuries old term for like, just like fertility.
Oh,
And so the egg and the steam is supposed to just like up your fertility. Like I should, in theory, after tomorrow, just be able to like walk around and get pregnant.
Right, like pollen from like a tree or something. Come on,
I might accidentally if there's
so
just
fertile.
Some,
wind.
Yeah. How much semen do you think is just floating on in the air? We're gonna find out.
Ambient semen.
We're gonna
a lot
find
of ambient
out.
Semen in this room.
Yeah. Let's
all right,
not
guys.
Take a black light to it.
Let's get. Oh. let's get into today's stories. We wanted to start out with. Something I hadn't even heard about, but apparently the U.S. revoked Bill Browder's visa. So this guy is, like Vladimir Putin's Vladimir Putin, to quote Steven Seagal's, sort of main enemy. He was one of the richest, people to be like heavily invested in Russia for, long period of time, and he suddenly had his money seized, and he like made a complaint to the Russian government because he thought it was, you know, corrupt people. This was back before people realized Putin was, you know, the bad guy in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was like, hey, our money was seized by this bank. What's going on? Like, can you help us out? And they threw his lawyer in prison. And that's when he realized, oh, Putin is behind this. And they basically tortured and beat the shit out of his lawyer, this guy, Vladimir Magnitsky, until he died after being in prison for 11 months. So this guy, Bill Browder, then, you know, in Magnitsky's name, got this legislation passed that basically seized any money that could be directly connected to Putin. And this is the law that Putin's lawyer was trying to talk to Trump's kids about when they had that meeting in Trump Tower
because
during
it's like
the election.
That act is like the first step of easing sanctions. Like all that money that's frozen, like it's basically this guy is Putin's like worst enemy.
Right.
And he's tried many times to silence him or get him arrested. Like he's tried to get Interpol to issue warrants, I think 4 times before this. And every time Interpol was like, no, dude, like this is politically motivated. Like there's no way we're going to do this. I think basically this time Putin has found a loophole to get this arrest warrant issued by Interpol. So I guess he finally has found a way to get Interpol to issue this arrest warrant. But what's interesting is, like, yes, the State Department also revoked this man's visa, which means, like,
it's the U.S. State Department.
The U.S. State Department has revoked his visa at the same time. it's very odd. I mean, it could legitimately be a mistake because sometimes like these warrants go out and then they're like sort of immediately deleted. But there's also, you know, obviously with the interesting relationships we see and connections we seem to have with Russia, who knows what this is really about. But yeah, again, with this, it doesn't seem surprising considering like Trump still hasn't done anything with Russian sanctions. And now suddenly our State Department is like, you know, helping Putin's agenda to, at least to limit the movement of some of his biggest enemies, which some people argue makes it easier for this man to be located by Putin's henchmen or whatever, because right. he doesn't have the ability to move pretty freely at this point.
Be fair, our president is pretty busy harassing Gold Star families. He's yeah. got a full schedule.
He does have a lot going on.
It's interesting looking at Bill Browder's Twitter feed, just that we live in a time where people can literally be live tweeting their own like ability to be in the country and whether he's arrested or not. Like his whole feed is just like, this is what's happening to me, everything is bad, and then occasionally like a very nice picture of him.
Really?
yeah
it's like at Olive Garden enjoying a meal.
He's looking fresh. He's clearly, you know, moisturizing through the pain, which is great. Respect.
Yeah, he also is apparently a British citizen, but he speaks like an American.
Yeah, he was born in America, but he's a UK citizen.
And also, he's extremely wealthy and probably not eating at the Olive Garden. I don't know why that is where I pictured him for some reason.
You're going to get sued for slander.
Right. but yeah, I mean, this guy, and specifically Magnitsky, who died, was like a total badass. Like, the entire time that he was in prison, like, they were just trying to get him to, like, admit to some trumped-up charge they were accusing him of. And the whole time, he would just, like, take diligent notes. He'd be like, okay, this is the law you're breaking by asking me that. He was just, like, such a hard-ass and, like, refused to give in and eventually died for it. And right. so that's why this is so fucking annoying and frustrating.
But again, yeah, it's a disturbing trend. I don't know. It's just weird to see that suddenly. I mean, usually, you know, America would be a haven, a place to protect people who would speak out against Putin.
Right.
And now we're sort of like, oh, yeah, okay. Well, I guess we'll cancel your visa.
Yeah.
How you like that?
All right. Well, let's move on to more serious news.
Mm-hmm.
The Madea films are back and crushing it at the old box office. Tyler Perry's Boo 2, A Madea Halloween, took in $21.7 million at North American theaters over the weekend, which gives him his sixth number one opening. It's really the first success in like Hollywood for the past few weeks. Like, it's been nothing but bad news other than this, and I guess Happy Death Day also did pretty well. But everything else, like the Blade Runner sequel and the firefighting movie, like all
tanked.
Oh, yeah,
tanked. The firefighting. Who wants to see a firefighting movie?
Right, when, honestly, like, real people are being killed by wildfires.
Yeah, the timing.
Yeah, the timing was rough.
Yeah.
Not good for them.
Not ideal. But there was no real-world activities to ruin Tyler Perry's Boo 2, A Madea Halloween, which there's never a bad time for that. But so I've never seen a Madea movie.
No.
I know.
Nor have I.
We have to give you the Ludovico treatment then from Clockwork Orange and ingest all these Tyler Perry films.
So, Miles, you have seen...
I've seen a few Madea movies in
Madea
my day,
films.
Yes.
Any faves?
Look, Diary of a Mad Black Woman, I think, was great. That was like his first one.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was like the first thing that had people kind of like, oh, okay. Like, what's going on with Tyler Perry? But over time, you know, Tyler Perry is kind of an interesting figure, like, especially with black moviegoers. Some people think what he's doing is great. Other people, to quote Spike Lee, he calls it coonery buffoonery. Like, you know, he says it's really problematic because he's just sort of perpetuating stereotypes. And in a time when, like, we had a black president, it just seems sort of counterproductive to sort of, like, have these really one-dimensional characters. But, you know, for me, I'm not a fan of any of his work. It's just, like, all really bad. Like, it's, like, regardless of like what I think of the portrayal of like African American characters. I just think like as stories, the shit is weak. Like everything is mad predictable. People criticize his work because, you know, he started off doing theater and they say that basically now his films are just versions of like theater where they're so big and extra because he's still caught in the mindset
extra
of like,
extra is the word for the work of Tyler Perry.
Yeah, it's extra. And it's like, you know, he's just trying to play to the back of the room and it's, I don't know. I mean, the films still do well because clearly he has a lane, right? Like there are people who do like what he does and his movies and maybe they like it because it's not really going to challenge the way you think. And it's just kind of like, it's just mindless sort of mind numbing entertainment. But for me, I don't know. I'm not really checking for it, but I also don't hate on people that who want to, because at the end of the day, like Tyler Perry has done a lot of like really pretty, spectacular and noteworthy things. Like, you know, he's basically built up the filmmaking industry in Atlanta and given a lot of black actors and people, like he's created a really solid film industry in Atlanta. And you know, he is successful and he's doing his thing. I really can't take any of that away from him. But objectively, like what his work is, regardless of what I think of the content of it, it's not interesting. It's not moving the needle in any way. It's just, it is what it is. And yeah.
I feel like, especially, I mean, right now, I feel like a lot of movies are tanking at the box office because they're so overly serious and just like a lot, just too much. Like, I feel like that's probably, beside the fact that I can't stand Blade Runner, and would rather take a blade to myself than see it. But like, it's just like, you know, it's 45 minute long shots and just like all this very heavy stuff where a Madea movie right now, especially, is just like straight up levity and fun. And I feel like right now we're in such a, the climate is such that that's like needed, almost like how movies would serve their audience in like a depression era of like, we just want to see someone who's happy.
Right.
And like, we don't want to be miserable in every space we walk into. And in that way, like, and again, I haven't seen the Madea movies, but there's like, back in like depression era Hollywood, there was like a million, series like this that would crank out a couple of films a year sometimes, and people would go and see it because it made them feel good and they weren't especially challenging. But like, even if you think about like old Andy Hardy movies and stuff, it just made you feel good. You knew who the character was. You weren't going to be challenged, and it would be a way to forget about stuff for an hour and a half.
For sure. And I think, given the situation of things in the world right now, this is probably the kind of movie you would want to see. It's just to be like, yo, fuck it. Like, let me just go to a bizarre parallel dimension where, like, people, like, have no idea what North Korea is. And, like, we're just...
Right.
We're able to just sort of focus on something else, just about Halloween and this eccentric woman.
There are fires outside. I don't want to pay $12 to watch another fire. And $12 is very low.
I was like, where are you getting your
money? At like 1 p.m. I don't want to pay $12.
And the other movie that tanked this weekend was Geostorm, which was full of just other like weather-bound disasters coming and, you know, coming out of the news to, you know, kill people in these high-budget blockbuster movies that are no longer blockbusters because nobody's going to see them. Yeah, I also just wonder how much of it is that he is, you know, one of the only people who is making authentically black comedies by a black man, like featuring black characters, like, you know, Barbershop 3 made $20 million in its opening weekend. I just wonder, like, the big breakout, like, blockbuster movies from the past 10 years are the Fast and the Furious franchise. And, you know, we tend not to, like, even mention the fact that these are the only blockbuster movies that has a actual diverse cast with, like, people of color and, like, the lead roles. And
well, I mean, I will say, like, Girls Trip is
so
definitely
good.
is the kind of movie that I wish, like, I think that's where the direction we need to keep going in. Like, that has a black director. It was written by, like, the screenplay is written by a black writer. And it did $136 million at the box office.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't know if I would – it's hard because then – I know you said, like, again, the use of, like, authentically black comedy. I don't know. Like, that sort of sent shivers up my spine to think – because I understand how, again, people are so divided over Tyler Perry. Like, I think it's a good – it's a great thing that he is able to do this and – and create opportunities for these actors. But yeah, again, I think I also like that we're starting to see these other films like Girls Trip that are coming up, because I think that also that brought in such a diverse audience. Like, I mean, I remember seeing like white people on Twitter, like, oh my God, this Girls Trip is great.
I was
and loving it.
I was one of those people. It was, yeah. It's such a good movie. It's
just
funny.
A good, yeah. And I think it wasn't really leaning into like, obviously the cast was all women of color, but it didn't seem like, you know, with like the way Madea films are marketed sometimes, it's almost like, hey, it's time for another Tyler Perry film. I think this, again, things are evolving. And I think, you know, Tyler Perry, he does his thing, but something new is coming.
Right. I mean, Tyler Perry, I feel like everyone can agree, is like not the highest common denominator. You know, he's not.
But it's movies that are written and directed by a black person.
Exactly.
Is what I'm saying.
And I think because for a long time there weren't many films like that. You know, that was like the reason why, you know, you tune in to TBS to see like Meet the Browns or House of Pain and those shows, because this was at a time where there were not shows like this around. So,
All right, we're going to take a quick break and be right back after this. And we're back. So, you guys, I wanted to talk about a couple things. I wanted to talk about the controversy over Trump's call to the military widow, but also, you know, just classism in America, and it is something that we talk about from time to time on the show, because America, it tends to be like a thing that America isn't aware that they have. We kind of like actively ignore the existence of a class system in America. Trump is kind of a good way to notice that there is a class system, because we tend to just think, okay, high class equals, or like upper class is somebody with a lot of money, and we associate class with money. But there's actually like culturally prescribed class divisions, and you know, Trump, even though he has a lot of money, a lot of his class indicators, like his accent, his participation in WWE wrestling, his taste in furniture, tend to all be more blue collar and things that aren't upper class, and sort of appeal to a lot of the people who, you know, ended up voting for him. But so we were talking about that, and one of our writers pointed out that military service kind of is starting more and more to be a sort of class-based thing, where there's like a military class that specifically fights in wars. And, you know, The Atlantic wrote that as a country, America has been at war nonstop for the past 13 years, but as a public, it has not. Because like a total of 2.5 million Americans, like 3/4 of 1% of the U.S. population, served in Iraq or Afghanistan. And a lot of them went back more than once. But then culturally, that doesn't really reach the rest of the population to a large degree.
You just mean in terms of like proximity of like how far we're removed from someone that we know who's in active military service or her.
How much that crosses over, how much the culture that we consume concerns itself with like those issues.
Right.
I think they were saying that about 80% of new recruits across the different branches of military have a family or extended family member who served, which means that if service duty isn't a value you were raised with, you're not going to seek it out yourself.
Right.
So it's almost like this division where it's a unique group of people that is separated out. And I think it ties into the Trump thing in the sense that he has no conception whatsoever of, you know, the values of that particular group of people. He has no conception of what, you know, the idea of sacrifice for country or anything.
Anything
that is not his own reputation. So I think when Kelly comes out and tries to imply that Trump was like secretly meant to say these things that completely go along with, you know, the values of the military class. Like, I think he's being disingenuous and probably not being totally honest with himself.
Wait a second. Donald Trump not honest, possibly delusional with himself?
Well, keep these hot takes to yourself.
Unbelievable.
And I think Kelly, too. I don't know. Kelly, I think when he took over for Reince Priebus, we were all like, well, good. Finally, somebody who doesn't behave and doesn't have the name of somebody who is a bad guy in like a Harry Potter book. But I don't know. I think that was probably wishful thinking. And I'm not totally sure like where our hope came from. Like General Kelly ran Gitmo for a long time.
Well, yeah, I think it just shows you relative to where everything is. It's like, well, as long as it's not the thing that's happening now, then it has to be better. And
right,
it's like
sure.
Well, if it's not Priebus, well, someone different, that means maybe something different will happen. Therefore, it could be better. But yeah, I mean,
and to Kelly's credit, I think, I mean, he has a history and he has a troubled history, but I feel like at least presents himself more on paper as like someone who wants to serve his country.
Right.
And so, I mean, even though you can like go into him, like what, I don't know, it's hard because it's like, who is the option then? Because at least Kelly has experience, but
yeah, it's an interesting experience.
Yeah, exactly.
His CV is kind of interesting, but he also too, when he was in charge of the DHS, he was like for the travel bans and for a lot of like this aggressive, like, you know, like immigration stuff. So, yeah, he's been a big supporter of the Trump agenda. So it's hard to see like, oh, how he could be the savior, in any way. But again, I think it just speaks to the fact that we are so sort of demoralized or just down about everything that it's like, oh, well, it's someone different. Maybe this will be the person that'll finally get Trump to get in line. But clearly that hasn't happened.
I mean, yeah, I think we're at a point where it's like, oh, the person with the job has like, even if it's like terrifying and bad, experience in the job.
Right.
Unbelievable. Like it's, yeah.
Right. At the same, I do think there's also sort of a tacit awareness that, you know, a lot of the people who are criticizing Trump about the way he spoke to LaDavid Johnson's
Maisha
widow,
Johnson.
That the people who are criticizing that conversation are not overly familiar themselves with military values. And so I feel like, you know, when Kelly came out and, you know, gave his speech, I don't know if everybody saw his speech, but he talked about what happens to a soldier when they are killed on duty. And, you know, it was very heartfelt and emotional. But underlying the speech, there were like these weird kind of values where he was basically saying that people shouldn't be able to criticize the president if they haven't served in the military. He like has this whole thing about how he was so upset after hearing criticism of Trump's phone call that he had to go walk among the finest men and women on this earth, and you can always find them because they're in Arlington National Cemetery. So he's like saying that unless you have fought and died for the country, then you don't really, I don't know, like, have the right to speak. And then at the end of the press conference, he took questions, but only for members of the press who had a personal connection to a fallen soldier, or people who knew a Gold Star family. So I don't know if he was like actively trying to comment on that, but I think that was sort of the cultural divide that he was working with. Like, look, you guys aren't aware, you like take for granted that there's just this class, this military class of people who are always going to be out there fighting your wars for you. And I do think that there's some truth to that criticism. At the same time, I don't think we should just be so sensitive about the fact that, you know, a lot of people don't know somebody who's active duty military or who, you know, anybody who's in the military in general. And we should be, I don't think we should be so sensitive that we just sort of let the generals sort of do whatever they want in this case.
It's a weird I mean, I was surprised when he came out there and gave that press conference, because I think like most people thought that it was a weird move for Trump to bring in John Kelly's deceased son as like a pawn in his game, in his chess game. And
well, because Kelly like was very intentionally not talking about that very frequently,
right,
and like had a whole line of thought as to why he was like didn't want to make it about him or about his family too much, and his so it was extremely out of line for Trump to bring that into it in the first place.
Right.
And so it seems like he was, because obviously like we've read a lot about how General Kelly like and people in the cabinet have to do a lot of double speaking. Like outwardly they will say things that when Trump reads headlines will not sort of like trigger him to go off the rails. But like privately, like they mean a whole other thing. It seems like this was like the hand that Kelly had to play to try and squash this whole scandal is by trying to say like, look, if you're not in the military, keep your mouth shut, which is also like, I don't think that doesn't people, if they don't have a connection to like a Gold Star family or someone serving, I don't think that means you can nullify like anything they might have to offer in a discussion about the subject.
Right.
I understand like what you're saying, like, sure, you have to, if you haven't lived through it, your lens of experience is probably quite different than someone that has, but we also need to be able to have like open discussions about these kinds of things, especially when you have people who are like Sergeant Johnson's widow who personally was saying like, I was offended by this.
Yeah.
That there shouldn't then suddenly be like, well, we can't talk about this because you didn't serve in the military. And like, I'm only gonna take questions from people that have.
Yeah.
That's
no, it's definitely, it's hugely problematic. The New Yorker reporter, Masha Gessen, who is, you know, from Putin's Russia and actually had to flee, because she was so critical of Putin, listened to that press conference and was basically like, this sounded super like a military coup. Like, it used the language and the logic of a military coup in the sense that, you know, it glorified dying in war and basically said the best people are people who have died for their country. And if you didn't die for your country, you have no right to even criticize the president and like how he spoke to this military widow.
The way that that whole press conference was framed was just a problem from the start. Because it's one thing if his point of view is, I don't think that we're like listening to Gold Star families enough. I don't think that their voices are being heard enough. That's something that I don't think a lot of people would disagree with. But the tone and the language, and then the very intentionally saying like, these are the only people who are allowed to ask questions, just, you know, it would have been very easy to have made a point that wouldn't have been, you know, excluding people intentionally.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And he also made it seem like the politician, Frederica Wilson, the congresswoman, who was listening in on the call, had like sort of invaded the conversation. But Maisha Johnson had voluntarily, you know, put the call on speakerphone while she was in the car with her mother-in-law and the congresswoman. And he was like so mad about that, General Kelly was. He was like, there are few things left that are sacred in this world. He was like, a bunch of things have lost their sanctity in our lifetime. Women, which is creepy. Life, religion, Gold Star families, which I don't know.
Well,
if
at
he
least
was,
three out of four of those, he has gone on the record as pretty much having no respect for.
Right.
So,
yeah, his boss, exactly.
Yeah.
And in fact, he said that the Gold Star families had been profaned in the convention over the summer.
Yeah, you're talking about Trump?
Right, which that would have been Trump, right?
With the Khan family?
I guess he's mad that the Democrats, like, used it
or
something.
Oh, come on. Yeah, shut the fuck up.
It just seems like he's
ridiculous. I mean, even him saying, like, oh, like, you know, communication between the president and a Gold Star family is sacred. Meanwhile, Trump just dragged your son out.
Right.
You know, like,
right.
But that's not sacred. I mean, like, this, like, picking and choosing of, like, what is sacred is.
And the flawed logic from the get-go of, like, you know, we're not being respectful of a president who has never served the public at all.
Right.
Even as the president has never served the public. Like, it's just, ridiculous.
And he's criticizing the media for reporting that this woman was offended, but I mean, she was offended, and she came out yesterday, I think, and specifically said, you know, I was offended. The president kept referring to you know, my husband as your guy, and like didn't even fucking learn his
name. Anyone's name.
So like, but her doing that is like somehow like sacrilegious to Kelly. It's just it. Listening over the weekend, I was listening to like ABC News, and they were completely buying into it. They were like, "Well, you can't criticize the general. He's the only one who knows. He's a 4-star general. Like you have to."
Yeah,
take
but look
his
at
word
his record.
For it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that doesn't make you above the law or above criticism. That's the slippery slope we're getting into
right.
here.
Yeah,
and also if you're in Gitmo,
right? Yeah,
you're
also
open
Fanny
to criticism. Like,
right?
I mean, agree that you know, in general, like especially on both coasts, we probably don't hear enough from military families and that point of view, and we could stand to hear more of it, but not at the expense
Absolutely.
Of silencing
I mean,
other people.
There's just in general, we have such a disconnect with people that have served. I mean, if we just look at the way we treat our veterans when they come back. Like, that's a huge issue that is still barely really getting the kind of attention it deserves. And also, I think in that article you're talking about, Jack, there was like this other stat in there that basically the number of veterans that serve in Congress has continually began declining. So are the people that are in government inherently are disconnected from the class of people or just this group of people who serve in the military. And we only have people sort of like John McCain and, you know, not many others who are kind of embody this actual like war hero serving in government.
Right. Fewer and fewer of them. I think it used to almost be like a prerequisite that you had like military background to be like a successful politician. But yeah, I think I mean, McCain yesterday was, you know, throwing shade at Trump. I think he talked about
bone
like,
spurs. Bone spurs.
Yeah, he's like some people.
Five deferments.
Trump got out of going to the Vietnam War by claiming he had bone spurs.
Time and time again.
Right. And so McCain made reference to that in comments yesterday. So I don't know. It seems like this sort of division between military people and non-military people is sort of, I don't know, all over the place right now.
Especially because John McCain, I mean, all due respect, the man is very old. And there's not a lot of people working in government right now who are both veterans and younger and like working with more progressive views than John McCain grew up with.
Right.
So it's interesting. I feel like John McCain often becomes the default voice for veterans, but he's also speaking from, you know, a couple generations back as well.
Right.
As many as 7 generations.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but
we may not know how old
there has been kind of like it with Democrats, like they have been starting to test the waters with like veterans running. But we'll see how that experiment goes. But yeah, I think what's also interesting to me is like with Trump actually, you know, having avoided serving in Vietnam like 5 times, I'm actually surprised how much people like in this military class who support him can look at him and think like, oh yeah, this guy gets it. Because normally like that would be an attack that these people would levy against anyone else. If they're on the other side of sort of like, oh, they haven't served, they wouldn't know, whatever. But we have the embodiment of someone who has never served and will never know.
By the way, a great candidate, Pete Buttigieg, who is a, I think, 35-year-old. He was commissioned as a naval intelligence officer in the Naval Reserve in 2009, deployed to Afghanistan in 2013, served 7-month deployment. I think he is the mayor of South Bend or something.
Indiana, yeah.
Yeah, 35-year-old gay mayor of South Bend, who's just like one of the smartest guys I've ever heard interviewed. He'd be a great, great candidate to bring the military service back to the elected office.
Go, Pete.
Jill.
Pete 2020.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk some Boy Scouts. And also, Jamie's going to tell us about some movies she's been watching.
Tee-hee.
And we're back. So, Miles, apparently Cub Scouts aren't even safe from censorship.
No,
says a headline that you added to. Our
I had to.
Doc.
Yeah, this 11-year-old Cub Scout,
cutie pie.
His name is Ames Mayfield. He's from Broomfield, Colorado.
Fucking dope name,
dude. Yeah, Ames Mayfield. He sounds like a
hell yeah,
like a funk artist, like maybe Curtis Mayfield's brother or something. Ames Mayfield. Anyway, He's in a Cub Scout, and he was asked to not return to his den after his group met with a state senator named Vicky Marble. And because basically this kid, like, he came with some questions for someone in government and asked, like, some hard-hitting questions about gun control and some problematic statements she made. And, like, this woman was shook.
The video was wild because it shot over the shoulder of Ames, and you just watch Vicky Marble, which also sounds like a fake name, fall apart.
My girlfriend Vicky Marble.
Yeah, she's from Canada. My girlfriend Vicky Marble.
Well,
she's not
a
cartoon.
You won't meet her because she lives. Yeah, she doesn't live here.
Too hot. She wouldn't like want to hang out with you guys.
But yeah. So this kid, she took some questions from the Cub Scouts, and this kid sounds like a full grown adult, and like he's saying stuff like, "I was shocked that you co-sponsored a bill to allow domestic violence offenders to continue to own a gun. Why on earth would you want somebody who beats their wife to have access to a gun?" This kid said it so calm, cool, and collected, because I think a lot of people want to levy the thing like, yo, his mom wrote that and she's just pushing her agenda through her kid or whatever. But in an interview, this kid actually seems like actually concerned by this. Obviously, he's probably hearing that in his house.
Right.
But
sure.
It didn't seem like he was forced to just read this thing like for a gotcha moment.
No, it seems like he was actually dumbing down his question for the congresswoman.
He was so
How do I put this so that you'll understand?
How do I put this in Vicky Marble terms?
And then he said another thing. Shout out to Woke Ames. Then he says, he told her straight up, he said, quote, "I was astonished that you blamed black people for poor health and poverty because of all the chicken and barbecue they eat." Whoa.
That was a quote from her?
So, okay. And then she goes on and she was like, "Oh, well, that was made up by the media." And she's like, and then she says to him, "You want to believe it? You believe it. But that's not how it went down." Okay. So when you actually look at the quote from Vicky Marble, she straight up said, "When you look at life expectancy," this is a quote, okay? "When you look at life expectancy, there are problems in the black race." Okay, first of all, pause, rewind. "Sickle cell anemia is something that comes up. Diabetes is something that's prevalent in the genetic makeup, and you just can't help it. Although I've got to say, I've never had better barbecue and better chicken and ate better in my life than when you go down south and I love it. Everybody loves it." So,
okay.
Fall the fuck back, Vicky Marble, with you. Again, thank you, Ames Mayfield, for being the wokest Cub Scout on earth.
Damn, he went in on the research.
Yo, he went
into Vicky
exactly.
Ames, and it's because he was, is he like, he's not in the same Cub Scout den anymore, is
so
that
yeah,
right?
Like a few days after the event, the leader of the Cub Scout pack in the area, because like there's the area, then there's like the dens within the area anyway, they informed his mom that he wouldn't be able to return to his den.
Because
it was too politically charged.
Let the kid return to his den, god
you
damn
think,
it.
You think his other like little Cub Scout mates in the den are like, "Yo, fam, like you really didn't have to flame her like that. This is too politically charged."
Well,
they're 11 years old. Like, he's the smartest kid anyway. He's already beyond these other kids.
What the fuck
kids.
Kind of message is that sending to kids? Like, yo, keep your mouth shut and
right.
just like.
Because it's not the kids making the decision. Like, what 11-year-old is going to not stand by their. It just doesn't. It's so clearly being made by the adults and not the kids. Because who wouldn't chill with Ames?
Yeah, I'm down to chill with Ames.
You mean like the decision to kick him out is the adults and not like
right?
His
it's not like
fellow.
The kids like we disagree with Ames's politics. Like, that's not
all right. And then to close things out, Jamie, you have a podcast called the Bechdel Cast.
I sure do.
Oh, you okay? I didn't need to tell you that.
Oh no.
Yeah, you're aware of that. So can you tell people the premise or I guess what the Bechdel test is?
Sure. So I host the Bechdel cast with my friend Caitlin Durante, and we talk about in the podcast how women are portrayed in famous movies. We use the Bechdel test as kind of like a general yardstick. So if you've never heard of it, it's invented by Alison Bechdel, who's author of Fun Home, has been a cartoonist and author for a long time. And it basically just does a movie at any point. It just has to be two lines of dialogue between two women who have names and talk about something other than
a
man.
The male character, right.
Right. And this happens not often. And it literally can be two female characters with names saying, "How's the weather?" "Cold." Done.
Right.
Or like,
"How's the weather?" Eric broke my heart.
Right. It's like, no, the clothes! No! You know, a lot of famous movies do not even come close to passing the test. It's bleak. But we talk about how women are portrayed sort of in general, also very bleak.
But so you guys just did a big one for the Bechdel cast. You did Manhattan.
We did. We did a special, not a special, but we did sort of an emergency episode on Manhattan, which is a movie I hadn't seen since college. So if you haven't seen it, please do not rush. There's no pressure to see a Woody Allen movie ever.
That's how I'm not going to lie. I've not seen Manhattan. I've only seen maybe two Woody Allen films my whole life because I don't know what it was. I'm just like, I was just never vibed with Woody Allen films.
Me either.
So I'm glad I'm now justified in my ignorance because many times people are like, you haven't seen blah, blah, blah. You haven't seen Annie Hall. I'm like, bro, I don't know. I'm like, you haven't seen Belly? The Hype Williams masterpiece? But yeah, just enlighten me as someone who's completely ignorant to Manhattan. What is the film about?
I will say that I love Annie Hall, but even I think I agree with you guys on Manhattan.
Manhattan is insane. It's still, to this day, on AFI's list of 100 best films ever made. And if you're familiar with the allegations against Woody Allen, which is that, you know, sexual abuse of minors in Manhattan, there a major plot point is Woody Allen's character sexually abusing a minor and having it be like, he's got a young girlfriend. He's dating Muriel Hemingway in the movie, who is 17 at the time of filming and in the movie as well. Woody Allen is in his 40s at this point. You find out and just the way it's treated. I mean, we get into it in the episode, but just the way it's treated and glazed over constantly throughout the movie is absolutely crazy. Cause there are some well-written female characters in that movie who do not seem bothered by the fact that Woody Allen is dating a high schooler and effectively assaulting her over and over. We see them in bed together. It's just, it's very disturbing and like pound for pound, just a awful, awful movie to watch. And the crazy thing is, you know, for so long and up until a few years ago when these allegations with Woody Allen were becoming extremely public, the main takeaway from this movie was like, wow, what a love letter to New York.
Right. That's
which is
all you ever hear about.
Crazy.
It. Even to this day. Like, if you don't listen to the Bechdel cast, like, the thing you're most likely to have heard of Manhattan is, what a love letter to New York. I mean, the
George
cinematographer.
Gershwin. It's,
yeah.
It's just, I mean, yeah, a guy does a thing with a light, but Woody Allen is assaulting a child over and over in this movie, and no one would ever talk about it. It's just, it's really, really bad. The way that everything is treated is just irresponsible and at best extremely juvenile and is kind of glorifying this kind of relationship because at the end of Manhattan, spoiler alert, they're sort of, you know, Muriel Hemingway and Woody Allen's characters are like, oh, maybe things will work out. Like,
right.
And then there's like a little smile from Woody Allen and then more George Gershwin and, you know, egregious shots of New York in the 70s and then it's over.
So it sounds like I should watch this movie.
Yeah.
Oh, no. God.
It's a beautiful love letter.
There's nothing good to say about Woody Allen. And also just in light of like the past couple of weeks, as far as I'm concerned, the whole art, separating art from the artist is, nope, we're done. We don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
This is a movie that no one should watch. There's nothing to take away from it except that there are a couple of nice shots, but that has nothing to do with Woody Allen and it has nothing to do with
his
message.
That's the cinematography, right?
Right.
So essentially it's normalizing like a very problematic adult and minor relationship.
Right.
Yeah. It's completely glorifying it and making it seem like a cute, like, midlife crisis for Woody Allen.
Right. So I'm going to date a child.
Yeah. It's like,
right.
It's like a thing where, like, another romantic comedy would have, like, he's a business type and she's, like, a free spirit. It's like, he's a 40 something and she's a.
And she doesn't even know what taxes are.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, it's
bringing him out of his shell.
I mean, and like the age gap between female and male leads in Hollywood in general is still a nightmare, but this is just like straight up illegal. Like,
are they kissing like on screen?
So one of the things I learned when I was researching this movie is that Muriel Hemingway, who is 17 at the time of filming, got her first kiss on screen in this movie from Woody Allen.
That's fucked.
Oh.
And then less than a year later, went to her parents' house and asked if he could take Marielle Hemingway, who was 18 then, but still completely unacceptable. He was like, can I take your daughter to Paris? Marielle Hemingway asked, will I get my own hotel room? And he said, nope. And so she said, okay, I'm not going.
Jesus.
But just disgusting, bad. No, don't.
Isn't that like, can you do that shit? Like, can you kiss like a child even if it's
on? Well, that's apparently in 1979, you could.
But like right now, right? If you did that, like first, that wouldn't even happen now, I guess, because people have finally woken up. But like,
the late 70s had a weird, like, pedophilia thing going on.
Right.
It was like, it was creepy. Like, there were all these, I did this on a video back at Cracked about just how there were like all these. There were these ads that were like nothing sexier than a baby, where like a young woman was like dressed up as like a baby doll licking a lollipop, and it was like,
Jesus Christ.
What were they selling?
They were
refrigerators?
Selling Love's Baby Soft perfume.
Oh wow,
it was really problematic. And there was also like, this is around the time that Brooke Shields became like a sex symbol as like a 16-year-old.
As a kid,
yeah.
Oh, in Blue Lagoon. What is that movie?
Well, yeah, but then, so Blue Lagoon, like, I think it's maybe just called Blue Lagoon, and then Return to the Blue Lagoon is like the sequel, but
right.
She, like, even after that movie came out, she was like Calvin Klein Jeans' like, sort of spokesperson. She was like the Kate Moss.
Me and my cat.
Yeah, and there's like a slow, one of the famous ads is like a slow shot that like goes up her body, and she's like, nothing gets between me and my Calvins. And it's like really this like disgusting male gaze thing that like.
Teenager.
So, I mean, that is clearly something that we're past, right?
It was just announced that in Woody Allen's new movie, aptly named because he cannot grow up, A Rainy Day in New York, also features a relationship with this exact same age gap with a man in his 40s and a 15-year-old girl who is referred to in quotes in the IndieWire article I'm reading as a concubine played by Elle Fanning. So,
concubine.
Cool.
Very tight, very cool.
lit, some would say.
Clearly, you know, like with age comes wisdom, except if you're like a white man who can get away with whatever the fuck he wants to do.
If you're a pedophile.
If you're a pedophile, apparently you don't grow out of it and you should be in jail. I can't claim to have seen the new Louis C.K. movie, nor do I have any interest in it, but I do know the plot of the movie. It's a very clear homage to Manhattan in that it literally features a character modeled after Woody Allen, I believe played by John Malkovich. And Louis C.K. plays a TV writer who has a young daughter who's sort of handing off his daughter to this Woody Allen type, while being a total, like his character is also, very lecherous. You know, it's weird because Louis C.K. is essentially acknowledging the allegations against him, which is that he serially masturbates in front of women, in this movie, but in a way that is totally like, forgiving to himself and saying like allegations are allegations and the line that people are taking away from this movie is like everyone's a pervert, which is the most apologist bullshit in the entire
right.
world.
And you say it ends with like him like sort of hitting on his daughter or something?
Right. I mean, and this is again secondhand information. I haven't seen the full movie. Yeah, where the sort of conclusion as instead of it being like, hey, don't hand off your daughter to a known pervert, it becomes like, well, everyone's a pervert, and then pulling out some garbage Freudian excuse.
Right.
For
like
the reason
he's only being
be.
Protective of her because he has like some weird Freudian thing.
Right. And then Chloe Grace Moretz, who plays his daughter, says a line to the effect of like, well, I've wanted to have sex with you since I was a kid because Freud. And it's like that.
To her own father?
To her own father. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, that's not okay.
So hard pass on, it seems like, and I hope that this movie has the opposite effect on Louis C.K. because it seems like, you know, from his point of view, he's like, oh, well, this will explain everything. And everyone's a pervert, so I'm not in trouble. But I think that it's going to blow up in his face in a
right.
major way.
For people who aren't aware, there's lots of smoke that suggests that Louis C.K. does horrible abusive things to women involving like getting them in a room and masturbating in front of them.
And acknowledges it in the movie where he has Charlie Day is in this movie and has a scene where Charlie Day masturbates to completion in front of a woman against her will. So he's very aware of what these allegations are.
So this is like his version of OJ's book, If I Did It.
Exactly.
Lawyers are like, what are you doing?
I don't know. I mean, thankfully we cannot put ourselves in his head because he is a bad person.
Right. I don't think he has masturbated to completion in front of anyone in this room, but like if you're an actress in Hollywood, like I know actresses who had auditions and, you know, their agent was like, just so you know, like this guy masturbates in front of people. So
it's just what he's like.
Yeah.
Like,
so just know that.
Right. Because everyone's a pervert.
Yeah. So you can draw a direct line from Manhattan to this movie, which, of course, is called I Love You, Daddy.
Gross.
See neither of them. That's my movie corner. Two movies to not see.
Jamie, beautiful. Where can people follow you?
I'm on Twitter at HamburgerPhone, and I got a website, JamieLoftisIsInnocent.com.
Miles, where can people follow you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at MilesOfGray.
You can follow me on Twitter at Jack_OBRIEN. The Daily Zeitgeist is at Daily Zeitgeist on Twitter, at The Daily Zeitgeist on Instagram, and The Daily Zeitgeist on Facebook. And Jamie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We will be back tomorrow because it is a daily podcast.